This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to Elgin Talks. My name is Andrew Lowry. I'm a content manager here at Elgin. And today I'm joined by Rob Martin, our Global Head of Investment Strategy and Research for Real Assets, and Senior Research Manager Matt Safair. Rob, Matt, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Andrew. Hi, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
And now you've both recently worked together on a report on the future of private markets, where you identify four key megatrends that you think are highly likely to shape portfolios moving forward. If people want to read it, they can find it on the Elgin Real Assets website. But for now, let's introduce it by saying that these four megatrends are deglobalization, digitalization, decarbonization, and demographic change. Can we start by just asking what led you to place such an emphasis on these trends in particular?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, most people will know that our part of the business is focused on private markets, and private markets are illiquid. They're hard to trade tactically. And we also don't, as a business, back ourselves to call market timing precisely. We do, though, have greater confidence in the ability to identify the critical trends that are affecting investments over the long term. And that's really what underpins our thinking here. What can we identify that will help us to deliver sustainable investment outperformance over the long term? And it's also about identifying and avoiding tail risks that could really harm portfolios. So it's also about promoting overall portfolio resilience. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we sort of observe on megatrends is, you know, clearly a lot of people think about megatrends. One of the areas that we think is sometimes quite overlooked is taking these high-level trends and then converting them into some real day-to-day decision-making on the ground now. And part of what we're doing with this and the processes and conversations that we're having within our business as well is about filling that gap, making sure that we're drawing the connection between these high-level themes and what does it actually mean in practice.
Now, we cover the megatrends in some detail in the report, but Matt, can you just briefly introduce us to them?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first two that I'll introduce are digitalization and demographics. And just to kick off by focusing on digitalization, what we mean by that is essentially the integration of new digital technology into existing business processes. So that sounds quite technical, but I mean, fundamentally, you only have to look at your everyday life to understand how big an impact digitalization has had on how we communicate with one another, how we access information, how we shop. So it's transforming our day-to-day lives. It's not essentially new, but it's also in transforming the investment landscape as well. And again, a prime example of that is you look at public equity markets, and you look at the start of this year, 30% of the S&P 500 was dominated by seven, the magnificent seven, essentially tech companies. So Apple, Nvidia, Meta, Tesla, Alphabet, Microsoft, Amazon. So clearly, digitalization is already having a huge impact on the investment landscape. And we expect that impact to persist. And we, in particular, think we've only really scratched the surface of the impact that things like generative AI, robotics, and quantum computing are going to have on private markets asset classes. So that's our first megatrend, digitalization. Our second one is demographics. Demographics is probably always a megatrend. And it's quite a well-worn phrase that demographics is destiny. And that is fundamentally because changes in demographic drivers, so by that we mean things like birth rates, life expectancy, by their nature play out over a long-term time horizon. And they are notoriously tricky, I guess, ultimately to shift once they become embedded. And you only have to look at countries like Japan and China, who have had a lot of challenges over the years in trying to I guess, shift some of the demographic outcomes that they're facing. If we come back to Western economies, actually, really, since the Second World War, we've actually benefited from quite a positive tailwind from demographics. If you think about the baby boom, improving health outcomes, urbanization, a lot of these factors have contributed to pretty good growth over this period of time and increases in disposable incomes. However, we do think we're on the cusp of a bit of a shift. We do think that tailwind is receding. And you can see that by looking at, I guess, the downward trend that we've seen in recent years around fertility rates, a really prime example of that is, you know, we've now had two consecutive years of population declines within China. But if you look closer to home in the UK and Europe, you're now seeing fertility rates at around 1.5 per woman in each of these countries. And that's well below the replacement rate. So what does that mean? Ultimately, it means we've got an older population. We've got a population that's likely to have higher needs in the future, but we've also got a shrinking labor force. And that does require, I guess, more thought in terms of how the built environment, how companies adapt to those demographic shifts that are taking place.
Rob, would you like to take up deglobalization and decarbonization?
Yeah, of course. They are a mouthful, aren't they? You know, we should have come up with some shorter words, but we couldn't find any that were better. So look, deglobalization is really encapsulating a couple of different things. One, it is about geopolitical tension. And the other side of it is about the emergence, arguably the re-emergence of populism in politics in a number of parts of the world. I think, you know, one of the things to say here is there was this tremendous growth in multilateralism and world trade after the end of the Second World War. And we, to some extent, became used to that. And that was obviously accelerated after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Soviet Union, this real sort of dominance of a fairly Western-dominated multilateral approach. That really stalled in the early parts of this century. And I think there are a range of ways in which that's now starting to move in a different direction. And what we're seeing is heightened concern over security and conflict, but also increasing barriers to flows of all different kinds around the world. I mean, trade is the most visible part of that, but it goes a lot further than that. It's about the trade in services. It's about the movement of people. And it's about movements in things like technology and critical resources. The other thing, which we don't really talk about a huge amount in this report, but is very important, is movements of capital. And I think we're moving to a situation where capital is not going to move around the world in quite the same way that it might have done historically. And there's a couple of recent examples of that. I mean, just last week, we saw the US administration signal that it was intending to block the acquisition of US steel by Nippon Steel. That is something I think a number of people were quite surprised by. It's clearly got a political dynamic around it, but that's one manifestation of how deglobalization is impacting the markets. We've also seen several private markets managers look to separate out their businesses, those which are operating in parts of Asia Pacific, from their wider businesses because they're finding it difficult to operate in a truly global way. I think those are two quite interesting straws in the wind. And then the final D is decarbonization. And there is clearly a huge amount wrapped up in here. At sort of ground zero, it is about electrification. It is about clean energy generation. It is about electricity distribution, but it is also about taking fossil fuels out of a whole range of industrial processes. Cement and steel are two of the most obvious examples there. But it's also about reducing demand for energy. So energy efficiency is something, as a real assets business, we think about a great deal in our buildings. But then there's a much wider perspective here on the protection and regeneration of nature. And we'll go on to talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And maybe one additional comment to make here is obviously these megatrends don't exist in isolation from each other. There are some real interconnections. And when it comes to decarbonization, yeah, it's very clear, I think, to anyone that thinks about it, is that climate change is a fundamentally unequal process. It disproportionately impacts people in the global south, those which in many ways are less able to cope with changes in the environment. Even if you don't believe it's right from a moral perspective, then decarbonisation is part and parcel with reducing long-term risk around security and conflict.
Thank you very much. These are obviously some pretty grand narratives that I think touch on our everyday lives. But what we want to do today is tease out their investment implications. In your report, you identify four sectors that are well placed for investors seeking to align their portfolios with these megatrends. Can you give us a brief overview of what these could be?
Yeah, sure, Andrew. So to kick off, I guess the first sector that we identify as a particular beneficiary from those megatrends is ultimately digital and high-tech sectors. So from a private markets perspective, what we're really thinking about there is are ultimately companies that are deploying this technology and developing this technology. But we're also thinking about the infrastructure and the real estate that also supports the growth of these industries. When we think about digital and high tech as a collective, really the lifeblood of this area, the industry, is data. And there's no doubt that the data being generated globally is growing at an exponential rate. Just to give you a fun stat around that, I mean, it's predicted that over the next 5 years, we will generate double the amount of data that was generated in the past 10 years. So, you know, this truly is rapid growth in terms of the amount of data that we're generating, processing, storing. You know, an additional tailwind that we've obviously seen over the past really 12 to 18 months has been really the adoption and development of generative AI tools. And we really see that as an area that is turbocharging the need to generate more data and also more power required to train some of these large language models. We see that as a positive. To get a bit more specific, we see that as a positive for digital infrastructure assets. So by that, we mean everything from data centers to mobile towers to fiber networks. So everything that really underpins the use and the connectivity of data. And we expect there to be significant additional capital requirements in order to service our growing needs for more data, more digital connectivity. One slightly side effect from that is that, you know, all this data that's been generated, that's been processed, is also impacting on power requirements. And we are seeing that being an increasingly key component of, you know, particularly data center site location strategies. Just moving away from, I guess, the digital infrastructure angle and just thinking about how digitalization intersects with demographics. We mentioned before about the fact that we're facing an aging population with more healthcare needs. We also think, you know, within the digital and high tech cluster, there is a lot of scope for further growth for life science companies, companies that are specializing in personalized medicine, really at the forefront of new research and development. And we think that benefits both companies and lending opportunities, but also specific geographic clusters where specialist lab facilities can be provided towards these businesses that can support their needs. So the second sector that we expect to benefit from these megatrends is residential sector. We see the residential sector as being a particular beneficiary of that demographics megatrend that we mentioned before. And that has a few different components to that. That is partly population growth. That's partly the fact that we've seen this trend towards smaller households across a number of Western economies and non-Western economies. And also we've seen this clustering, I guess, of people into more urban areas over the past few decades. And what that essentially means is that there is increasing demand for housing in specific locations, and supply, again, in many kind of submarkets and in many countries, is struggling to react to those increases in demand. This has created the conditions, and we've seen this over an extended period of time, for rental growth there across a number of different markets has outstripped inflation over a longer term horizon. If we think about residential also in the context of some of those other mega trends, which are slightly more disruptive, particularly something like deglobalization, really the fact that residential is needs-based is fundamentally counter-cyclical in terms of how revenue streams grow. We also see as a positive as we move into a slightly more volatile macro environment. One thing we would say is that when we talk about residential, it is a broad asset class. You know, it spans everything from specialist build-to-rent accommodation to affordable housing to senior living, but also student accommodation as well. And again, when we think about how these different megatrends interact with one another, this is another clear area where, you know, the impact of deglobalization will be a factor in the growth of student accommodation going forwards. And the fact that, you know, so many universities these days are more tilted towards international students, and the fact that if we do have restrictions around population flows or visa flows from international markets, that will be an increasing consideration going forwards. What we would say is that that doesn't mean that we don't support the student accommodation sector and the opportunities that it represents, more the fact that we think there's an increasing need to tilt towards higher quality institutions.
Rob, would you like to pick up the story with regard to energy and industrials?
I will. And there's almost too much to talk about here, but this very much sort of keys off decarbonisation. Yeah. To some extent, I think people, certainly in the investment world, certainly in the infrastructure world, we've been talking about the need for more renewable energy generation for a long time. And to some extent, you sense that people almost are taking it for granted. But we should not get, you know, we should not just look past the fact that we do still need a huge amount of additional renewable energy capacity. There's one stat that says Europe's energy transition alone needs around 840 billion euros of investment, which is clearly a huge opportunity, a huge capital requirement. We do see strong potential in energy, electricity generation, wind and solar, and from a wind perspective, both onshore and onshore. With that, we need to do a lot more in terms of having battery storage to be able to store that energy so that it is dispatchable when the system needs it. And you know, to the point about the system, there is still a huge amount of reinforcement that needs to take place to actually have an electricity distribution system that can cope with this kind of demand. So the traditional utilities are still going to be investing in very high volume here. And there's a huge amount of innovation around this as well. I mean, there's the greening of industrial processes. I mentioned steel and cement, and clearly very, very material both for the building sector, but for infrastructure and for industrial processes more generally. And there's a lot of innovation happening there, both within existing businesses, but also in new and emerging businesses. And I think there's some really interesting sort of venture capital opportunities in this space. Just to give an example, our sister division, Legal & General Capital, is invested in a firm called Oxford PV. And their business model is to research the application of perovskite to solar panels. That has a really big impact potentially in terms of the amount of electricity you can generate from a given footprint and cost, as much as 20%. If you scale that kind of impact across, you know, all of the solar panels that we could have, you know, either in a country or globally, that's a very material impact in terms of electricity generation. So there's a whole range of interesting applications here. And the other area that we think is very favored by several of these mega trends is industrial and logistics real estate. If I start with digitalization, e-commerce has really powered the demand for logistics space over the past 10, 15, 20 years. The UK has led the world here, but it's not remotely just in the UK. There's still increasing penetration for e-commerce, both in the US and in Europe. And that's really powering demand for urban logistics. Deglobalization, we would also say, is a positive, if you like, for industrial and logistics. We're seeing greater frictions in trade, more event risk, and that's really giving a focus on just in case versus just in time. So it is creating more demand for a resilient and stable logistics sector. And there is also, you know, we call industrial buildings. They're often not actually doing the things that people often associated with industry, i.e. manufacturing. But that, I think, is going to start to change. Reshoring has been pretty limited thus far, in truth, but we see it as being likely to increase. Most obviously, that's already happening in the US. The CHIPS Act has created a lot of support for reshoring certain aspects of the semiconductor industry. In fact, we've participated in several transactions which have very much been associated with that. Another example would be that the European Commission has announced its first ever defense industrial strategy. There's still a long way to go there, but it is, I think, indicative of the fact that countries are going to seek to be rebuilding their manufacturing bases where previously these might have been taking place offshore. So that, for us, is a big tailwind to the creation of those kinds of assets.
Thanks. That's a huge amount of ground covered in a very brief amount of time. What does this overall tell us about portfolio construction, do you think?
Yeah, so, I mean, there is probably two sides to this. There is the high level and the practical, crunchy investment decision-making. Certainly, this whole work does give us some particular steers in terms of sector rotation, sectors that we want to tilt towards, but equally some sectors that we're going to tilt away from. We've naturally spoken a little bit more today about the areas that we're tilting towards, but there is clearly thinking in our minds about where we're going to be scaling back. But it's also very much a day-to-day decision making. And for instance, in our private credit investment committees now, we have a specific place and a placeholder to talk about mega trends for every transaction. How is this transaction affected by one of these 4Ds? Is it affected by one of 4Ds? And if it is, can it be resilient to either the risks inherent, or is it a beneficiary of these trends and therefore something that we would seek to lean into, maybe even scale up our exposure to? So it is both high level, but it's also practical and day to day.
And in the report, you also identify 4 emerging sectors that you see as carrying particular opportunities. How do these align with the megatrends, and what makes you see them as carrying this potential?
We'll just cover off one of the emerging sectors that we think is of particular interest and really has the potential to really become a new channel of private markets, and that's natural capital. And so what we mean by natural capital is ultimately the planet's stock of renewable and non-renewable natural resources. Everything from land, air, water, soil, minerals, living organisms can be classified as natural capital. From more of an investment perspective, we're thinking about, essential minerals, we think about forestry, we think about agriculture. And I think the really interesting element around natural capital is the fact that historically, when people have thought about natural resources, they typically thought of them in terms of extraction. And I guess there's been potentially some negative connotations around that. But what we are seeing is a real material uptick in interest around more sustainability linked areas of the natural capital universe. So we're really thinking in terms of natural climate solutions that have a real clear focus around sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. That could be anything from afforestation to regenerative agriculture to restoring kind of natural ecosystems that take carbon out of the atmosphere. And I think what that is creating is what ultimately we think will be a new asset class within private markets that will have quite different return drivers to what it looked like 20 or so years ago. So both the capacity to generate an income from that land, but also the possibility to supplement that with high quality carbon credits off the back of those activities.
I think the other area that we would talk about is actually going to sound a little bit challenging. And it is about minerals and minerals extraction and resourcing. And a lot of investors have been seeking to actually scale back their exposure here, primarily because of the association with coal and with fossil fuels. But and our head of climate solutions, Nick Stansbury, has talked about this extensively. But it's widely understood that the clean energy transition is also going to have a requirement for a whole range of materials: cobalt, copper, graphite, lithium, then some more obscure materials like neodymium. And the transition could require up to 6.5 billion tons of these materials cumulatively up to 2050. And I think we can't get away from the fact that that is going to require new mines, and it is going to require us to expand the existing supply of these materials quickly. And from a deglobalization perspective, there's also a question around the security of supply here. 70% of rare earth extraction takes place in China. Now, clearly this process needs to happen alongside a sustainable and responsible production of materials. But we do think that investors need to embrace this sector, particularly if they want to be progressive around ESG, is rather than just exclude it, but embrace this sector and seek to drive and incentivize high standards. And another aspect here is the recovery and recycling of these types of materials. By the late 2040s, over 50% of additional demand from battery production for cobalt, graphite, and lithium could be met by recycled supply. This is a new asset class that we see as potentially becoming really material for investor portfolios.
That's a huge amount to think about. If you want to read the report, you can find it on the Elgin Real Assets website. Rob, Matt, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.